Okay, can you hear me?
I hear you great.
Okay, good. So I'm gonna dive in with the little bit of intro we have here, and then we'll get into some questions. We're here with Robert McChesney. He's professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois, and he's the media scholar featured in the new documentary film, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And that's based on his book of the same name. Professor McChesney, thank you for taking this time to talk with us today.
My pleasure to be here.
So just to set this up a little bit, I'll tell a little bit about the film. Digital Disconnect provides a broad overview that documents the birth of the internet as a government-subsidized project, which some folks aren't even aware of, probably, to the remarkable ways that today it now influences almost all aspects of our society, especially with the rise of social media. There's been a lot of discussion about what the internet is doing to individuals or how individuals are using the internet. But I think your film, Professor McChesney, takes a larger, more systemic look at how giant companies and capitalism itself has changed the internet in major ways. Professor McChesney, let's start with your thoughts on how has the internet changed communications and the media before we talk about how capitalism is changing the internet itself.
Change communication in the media? I'm not sure I follow the question.
Communication in general, in society, and specifically how it's changed our media, how people are getting information now.
Well, that's not a very easy question to answer. You hit me at the top one because it's very complex. On one hand, it's very simple. Clearly, the internet has made it possible to have rapid communication and access to wealth of material instantaneous, and it's changed our society dramatically. When you add in social media and cell phones and wireless communication, put the whole package together, we live in a world today that basically is almost antithetical, or at least it's radically divergent from just the world of a generation or two generations ago. People 30 or 40 years ago would have no idea what the world they were about to enter. Young people today in college, when I tell them what my experience was like in the 70s, how people communicated or got information, they almost think we were living, in like cavemen or something. They can't imagine how human beings could even survive in that environment where you weren't in constant, immediate touch with everyone 24/7. So, yeah, it's been a revolution, such an immense one. It takes time to pause to really see the extent of it. So at that point, it's crucial. Now, as for our media system, it's had dramatic effects on media, culture, entertainment, journalism, some for the better and some very much for the worse.
To follow up on that question, some of the ways it has impacted the media negatively, I saw a figure, which actually is a couple of years old now, that 20 years ago, about over 80% of households received a daily newspaper, and now the number that receive a daily newspaper are fewer than 50%.
Yeah, and given the quality of daily newspapers, I think that figure is going to be approaching 0% probably within a decade. They get progressively worse as they lose their revenue base, so they have less reporting and original material. And so people can find that sort of material easily enough online. There's no reason to get paper and ink. But you're right. The crucial problem is not the loss of newspapers. It's the collapse of journalism, the practice of journalism. We have far fewer working journalists today than we did 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's been a dramatic collapse in the practice of journalism. So the huge sections of public life that used to be covered by competing independent newsrooms now get no coverage whatsoever. Or you have one newsroom that might sort of cover it superficially, but with no competitive pressure to do a good job, no one watching them. So the work is predictably lame. This is a major crisis of American society. Most Americans are unaware of it. because if you go to the internet, it seems like you're flooded with data and information. It seems like there must be all sorts of journalism going on. But when you actually lift the hood and look underneath and see what's there, what you find is that most state governments hardly have any coverage anymore. Many states down to one or two reporters that might actually be covering the state house. And depending on the size of the state, that's a huge fall from just 25, 30 years ago. Now, is the internet entirely responsible for the freefall collapse of journalism? No. But it is largely responsible for the fact that the commercial model of journalism is dead and will never return, because that commercial model was based on advertising support, which really paid for about 80% of all the revenues that supported journalism in the United States. But advertisers never supported journalism because they cared about journalism. It was purely opportunistic. Buying ads in newspapers and news media was a way to reach their target audience. In the age of the internet, they no longer need to support content to reach their final audience, their target audience. They can go online, place their ads, and we know that they know everywhere we are online. The surveillance capacity of the internet is so intense. And the advertisers can find you wherever you are. They don't need to buy an ad on a newspaper to grab you. And as a result, news media do not have the revenues, and they are in free fall collapse. The smartest capitalists in our society, the smartest businesses, have abandoned journalism. They don't think you can make money doing it, and they're absolutely right.
So do you think the big media companies, are they influencing the reporting and news in the media companies? We're really seeing a polarization of media, Fox News, CNN. I mean, they're kind of having political viewpoints in their reporting. Are you seeing an influence in that area?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think the collapse of actual reporting, the disintegration of it, is really exemplified by something like Fox News and the other networks you mentioned, but especially Fox News. A lot of people think the revolution of Fox News was that it brought explicitly partisan reporting to television news. Really, like, they made no pretense that they were objective, neutral, nonpartisan. I mean, they might have made a pretense, but no one took it seriously. And they just basically said, we're with the Republicans, that's our team, and we're going to be there. We're there, they're propped up. We're presenting their viewpoint on all issues. And really, though, that's not the Fox News revolution. The Fox News revolution in the 1990s was they realized that they could do a news channel and make a fortune by doing no reporting. I mean, they don't ever cover anything. They have no reporters. They don't do journalism, per se. They basically just have celebrity blowhards on the air who just present talking points for the Republican Party in an entertaining, bombastic manner. And that is exceptionally profitable because your costs go way down when you don't have any reporters and you just have blowhards on the air. And that's all they've got. And so when you lose core journalism, you don't have much left. Basically, you're reduced to what they do at Fox and CNN and MSNBC, which is endless gossip on who's going to be the Democratic candidate for president. We're already in the middle of hours every day of absolutely meaningless, nutritionless garbage about who's going to be the Democratic nominee. Not a single boat will be cast for a year on that. All we learn are their mindless predictions. Well, that's cheap, inexpensive stuff to do. That's not reporting. So I think that if you're not going to have reporting, then you've got to offer something. And what these networks have discovered is the thing you offer in that context is your opinions, and you be entertaining, you pick sides in the debate. Otherwise, people have no reason to watch you. If you have no news and you have no opinion, then you're nothing.
Yeah, it's actually a contradiction, isn't it? We have more information available to us now than ever, but instead of broadening our perspectives, it's acting to actually harden us into narrower viewpoints, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't get too hung up on that. I mean, I know everyone does. It's a popular thing that we're in our silos and we're hardened and, you know, and it's ironic with all this information. For one thing, I would say there's a lot of data out there, but there's not that much information about a lot of stuff. It's garbage. There's no coverage of the state house in Wisconsin to speak of. There aren't any reporters covering it. There's City Hall or all sorts of issues. Now, you might find a lot of nonsense online in a Google search related to it, but we aren't going to find much actual reporting on what's being done. So I don't think there's a lot out there. There's just a lot of, there's a blizzard of data, bits and bytes, but that's not the same thing as credible journalism or any sort of journalism, incredible journalism. And so, you know, I think people go into these so-called silos because there's nowhere else to go necessarily. I mean, I think that, you know, people, it's not like there's a lot of options really otherwise.
So how do you see the ISPs taking advantage of the repeal of net neutrality? Is anything happening now?
Yeah, the cable and phone companies, which are government-created monopolies, these are companies that couldn't win free market competition if their life depended on it. They exist because they got monopoly licenses from the government. They had no competition in the cable companies and phone companies historically. And then they parlayed their extremely gifted lobbying prowess, because their whole business model is getting these government contracts, monopoly licenses. They parlayed that into control over access to the internet. Basically, that's who you're getting your internet access from, one of a very small number of companies like Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon. And what this whole battle over net neutrality is about is that these companies want to take their dominance of internet service provision, of having access to the internet, and privatize it. So they can basically set up toll booths all over the internet to make more money. And, you know, this is something that is, you know, dreadful from the perspective not only of people, citizens, people using that, but even for most other businesses that don't understand why these monopolists should be allowed to set up toll booths. And most Americans oppose it because they know it's going to make the internet more expensive and less open. That's what the struggle is. So they're going to try in ways to charge more, and they have no competition to speak of. They own the government. The FCC under the Trump administration is a wholly owned subsidiary of the cable and phone companies. But it's not a dead issue. While Trump and his incredibly corrupt people at the FCC he's appointed, while they will, they've gotten rid of debt neutrality, I think in 2 years it'll be back in place. If, of course, they haven't put it back in place before then.
So that goes to one of the big themes that are in your film, and that is how economic forces are shaping the internet we have today. Can you speak to that? The core of the film, right?
Yeah, when the internet began, and you alluded to this in the introduction, when the internet began, it was for decades, from the 60s, 70s, 80s into the 90s, it was an entirely non-commercial, non-profit undertaking. In fact, any commercialism was banned on the internet until the 1990s. And I was there at the beginning, and some of you may have been too, or some of the people in your audience at the film tonight may well be from the generation that remembers when the internet first really became popular in the early 1990s with the advent of the World Wide Web. And then people started going online between 1990, 91, and 94 or 5, and then it exploded. And even at that early moment, no one figured out how you could make money on it. It was clear this was a revolutionary phenomenon, but it was entirely unclear where the money was going to be made, what they called the killer application would be. And that lasted for a long time, except for internet service provision. No one was really sure what you could do online to make money. And then that all changed, and it changed for a variety of reasons. But before it changed, in the 1990s, if you were to read any book about the internet, the assumption was that it was going to be the greatest help for capitalism ever, that it was going to make capitalism much more democratic, much more competitive. It would open up opportunities for entrepreneurs and small businesses to compete with the big guys. It was a win-win for the human race. The only losers in the 1990s from the emergence of the internet was going to be those big, clumsy corporations that wouldn't be able to keep up with the nimble entrepreneurs online. It was going to be a glory age of capitalism coming. Well, regrettably, the exact opposite has been the case. And that's something no one anticipated in the 1990s, and now we live with it. And I think in Digital Disconnect, the book, which came out in 2013, and then the subsequent film that you're watching, I go through that because it's something I've been chronicling. And the irony is that the internet, rather than being a source of spectacular competition, has been the greatest generator of economic monopoly in the history of capitalism. By far, there's not even a second or third place. It's unbelievable what an extraordinary mechanism monopoly that it has become, such that the five dominant companies on the internet are all basically there because they have big areas online where they're the main company. They're the monopoly provider, and they have no real competition. And these are the companies we all know, Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft. Facebook might have slipped a little bit, but for a long time, and maybe still, those were the five most valuable companies in the world economy, certainly the five most valuable in the United States. Facebook, because of its problems, might have slipped down to seven or eight globally, but the other four are the top four. And so these are companies that are, you know, we've never had an industry that's dominated the list of largest firms, most valuable firms like this ever before in the history of capitalism, all from this one sector. And they're there because they're monopolies. Investors say this is, you can't go wrong with companies that are monopolies. And it's important to understand that when you use the term monopoly in economics, it doesn't mean that you have a monopoly in the sense that it's only one company that provides the service. A monopoly in economics means you have the company is so large it can control how much competition it has. Even John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil at its peak, never refined, I think, more than 82 or 83% of the oil in the United States. There were other oil refineries. But he had controlled enough of it that he could basically set the price and determine how much competition he ever had with Standard Oil. And that's what these big companies have. So we have an internet that doesn't have a lot of burgeoning entrepreneurs. We have these big guys that completely own the field. And this is a real crisis for democracy because there's one thing that's almost an axiom of democratic theory is that monopolistic control over the economy is incompatible with democracy because the big guys have way, way, way too much power. And people in the northwest of this country in the Rocky Mountains in Idaho and Montana probably know this well because they lived through these great struggles 100 years ago, as did the people in the upper Midwest. That was the great battle of that era.
So what are the steps American citizens can take, both on the larger issues surrounding the future use of the internet as well as their own personal use, to protect themselves in this situation?
Well, these are political issues. So, you can floss your teeth and wash your hands after you go to the bathroom. You do all the personal stuff you want. But in the end of the day, these are broad social political issues that have to be met with public policy to have really fundamental change. So we need policies like net neutrality, preventing the privatization of the internet by the phone and cable companies. We need to have really strict surveillance prohibition so that people can have genuine privacy and not be spied on without their permission. That's an interesting thing. You have to give permission to be spied on. We also need to have public policy to rejuvenate journalism so we actually have independent competing newsrooms covering our communities. It's very hard to imagine a functioning democracy without journalism. In fact, it's impossible. We're very close to testing that theory in the United States today, and it's maybe one of the reasons we have someone like we do in the White House today. It's a journalism-free environment is a playground for tyrants and frauds. So those are places to start. I think also we have to look at these big monopolies that run the internet, like the big five, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. And we have to ask ourselves, as America did 125 years ago, what can we do about this sort of concentrated monopolistic wealth these firms have? And maybe we should start thinking about them rather than for-profit companies out to satisfy investors, but make them into public utilities since they provide a service that they monopolistically control that's so important. And this is important to explain. The reason why we have so much monopoly power online isn't that these entrepreneurs are so much smarter than all the other CEOs in America for the last 100 years. The reason is that they are beneficiaries of what are called network effects, which means that if you control a network, and almost all internet business is a network, the way it works is that whoever is in first place gets all the business because networks get exponentially stronger when they add people, and the second, third, fourth place networks all collapse eventually. So if you're going to do social media, you're going to use Facebook. I mean, if you go to MySpace, there'll only be 10 other people in the world who are on MySpace. You've got no one in your to play with. You go to Facebook, you've got 2 billion people that you can play with. So the number one company in social media wins the battle. Same thing with Google search. Who are you going to use, Google or some search engine that, you know, doesn't have hardly any traffic and is much less reliable? If you're going to buy a book online, who are you going to go to, the company that's got Amazon, that's got every book and warehouses all over the place and can charge much less, or some other service? Well, 99% of Americans pick Amazon for that reason. So these are monopolies that are created by the nature of the internet, the digital world, not because their entrepreneurs deserve monopoly status or people want it. And maybe it's time to say these sort of monopolies just are incompatible if we want to live in a free society. They're the sort of things you'd find in a feudal and an undemocratic world.
You know, as we're coming into this next political season here, these are huge issues. How can people move the needle? How can they get the candidates talking about these things?
Well, some of the candidates are, fortunately. You know, you'll see some of the, and I think these issues will continue to emerge. You know, I think at the Democratic side, we're seeing Senator Warren, Senator Sanders have taken up these issues. And I think the other senators, from what I can see, they seem to be jump on the bandwagon when an issue catches on. So if there's momentum, I think the other senators or the other candidates will start talking about it, too. And I think, you know, but I agree, we've got a long way to go. And I think asking candidates about it, pushing them on it, in particular, I think the one I would say, if you have no other issues, the issues of surveillance, of monopoly and journalism. Those three are the crucial ones that Americans should constantly pester candidates about and get their attention, because they have to be solved. And if we don't have journalism, it's game over. Hmm.
So, Professor McChesney, we only got a minute or two left here, but what would you like viewers to get out of the film?
Well, to understand that the internet that we see today, that my children have grown up in and assume it's sort of the natural order of things, is the result not of market forces or freedom or political debate, but it was really, it's the result today of powerful companies taking over, changing the protocols so that you could have surveillance, which was impossible to do in the 1990s, but it got changed to make it more profitable. And that the sort of power of these companies that dominate it is something that can be addressed politically. There's nothing natural about it, and it has to be addressed politically. This is a political issue, first and foremost. It shouldn't be. This film is not sort of a picture of a landscape over which people have no control, like the Rocky Mountains, but rather it's a picture of a landscape that is our own creation, and we need to understand that and change it to something that works for us, not against us.
Are you optimistic for the future?
Very.
Because of the ability of our people to actually coalesce around this?
I'm optimistic because I teach college students all the time, so I've been doing it for about 40 years, 35 years now. And I would say in the last decade, I've seen a fundamental shift take place among young people. Much more openness to being asking critical questions. I think the system doesn't work as well for young people. So the idea that you just mind business, do what you're told, and you're going to get a good job and you can live happily ever after, that sort of thing that I grew up with and my generation grew up with, that doesn't apply anymore. Some people that applies for, but for most, life is a struggle, and they know their life's going to be a lot worse than their parents and they're a lot worse than their grandparents. And as a result, they're open to thinking critically, saying, okay, maybe we can do better. This is, why do we have this outrageous situation? And I think in that context, I think we see an openness to sort of new ideas and experimentation that really hasn't been very common in the United States for a long time.
Well, Professor McChesney, thank you again for speaking with us. Again, your film, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet into Against Democracy, will be shown tonight at the East Bonner County Library at 6 p.m. And we hope all our listeners will come and take in the film. There's a ton more there than we've touched on here. And join us in the discussion. So thank you again, Robert.
Hey, my great pleasure. And thank you for showing the film. I hope people enjoy it.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And Professor McChesney, I just want to say thanks again for joining us. We'll edit this part out.
Sure thing. No, yeah. Yep. And could you send me a link for this? I'd love to have it on my records.
You bet. Yeah. We'll be happy to do that. We'll actually get it posted up as a podcast on the KRFY.org website probably next Wednesday afternoon. And I'll let you know how the evening went too with the film.
Yeah, please. Thank you very much. And again, thank you for doing this.
Yes, thank you very much, Dr. McChesney.
Bye now.
Sure thing. All right. Bye. Bye-bye.